the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to rightly seat us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
She blinded me with science. She blinded me with science. Fell into geometry.
Is the scientific establishment still about following the evidence to truthful conclusions, or are there other considerations that drive, well, academia, any popular science show you might be watching on television? Is there philosophical ideas at work behind that that make following the evidence to the truth secondary, maybe not even following the evidence at all? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about the failures of scientism, Jay Sonstrom. He's a member of Our Savior's Way Lutheran Church in Ashburn, Virginia. He's a physicist and optical engineer. He spent his career as an experimental scientist for the United States Army's Night Vision Lab. And he's authored the new book, Loving Science But Not the Empire, How Real Science Reveals a Creator, But the Establishment Keeps Us in the Dark. Jay, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you today.
Describe the scientific establishment that you have dubbed the empire.
I was having a conversation with somebody trying to explain what I see as an establishment that kind of controls scientific flow of information. It was just kind of a little bit injection of humor, but to call it the empire. In my book, I relate that to kind of the Star Wars saga and try to add a little bit of humor to the book and the analogies to help people understand what's going on. But really, the empire, it's widespread. It includes academic research, science journals, our education system, especially the public school systems, our public museums and institutions, legacy media, including, you know, if you're watching news or you turn on PBS or Smithsonian Channel, or anybody showing a nature show, what you see on those channels is kind of controlled by the same empire. Even our courts and our legal system, it's kind of a package deal. They control the flow of information, and most of the public is probably not even aware that this is going on because it's science. You know, it's all just put in the terms as proven science.
What are the first two laws of thermodynamics, and why are they crucial for evaluating the claims of the scientific establishment?
Yeah, good question. That goes straight to chapter one of my book that I call Defying Common Sense. The first law of thermodynamics says that energy cannot be either created or destroyed. And, you know, this is based on a century of research in physics, especially. So energy can be converted from like one form to another, but it can't be created or destroyed. So if you got that, if that's a law of science, one of the most basic of laws, then, you know, how do you explain how the universe came to be? How do you explain how these things with tremendous amounts of energy came to be, like stars? And just think about our sun and all the energy it provides to the earth. So that's the first law. The second law basically says that things tend to go from order to disorder. In the book, I include a quote from Isaac Asimov as he defined these laws decades ago. He says, another way of stating the second law then is the universe is constantly getting more disorderly. He says, viewed this way, we can see the second law all about us. We have to work hard to straighten a room, but left to itself, it becomes a mess again very quickly and very easily. Even if we never enter it, it becomes dusty and musty. How difficult to maintain houses and machinery and our own bodies in perfect working order. I know that's true of me. How easy to let them deteriorate. In fact, all we have to do is nothing, and everything deteriorates, collapses, breaks down, wears out all by itself. And that's what the second law is all about. In my book, I make a big deal of the second law. For the average Joe American just going through their lives, they're probably aware of Murphy's Law, which says, you know, if something bad can happen, it will happen, and at the worst possible time. In my book, I provide every chapter starts with a little story from my personal life or one of my close relatives about encounters with Murphy's Law. It's just pervasive. Everybody knows this happens. And yet the scientific establishment pushes on us the concept of evolutionism, for example, which says that things went from nothing and no living things to living things and then more complex living things and then more and more complex until eventually, you know, the peak of all of this is human beings. And you look at the complexity of a human being, and just to say that this came about while the second law of thermodynamics is running all the time, it's ludicrous. It defies common sense completely. And yeah, that's what I called my chapter one in the book, Defying Common Sense.
Why do we need the scientific method?
You need rules, you know, to see that they're doing things correctly. In particular, the scientific method is the way that we go through science systematically. You come up with a hypothesis, you make predictions based on the hypothesis, then you test the predictions, you repeat the process, and that's kind of the system. Things have to be testable. They have to be repeatable. In my background, I came from working for the Army. You had to actually make things work. You had to, if you were coming up with a new gadget or a new system. In my career, I worked in lasers and electro-optical systems, especially infrared systems that soldiers used to see at nighttime. You can't just do hand waving and say, hey, I think we ought to do this. Not show any evidence for it. You need to have a systematic method of showing that what you're doing is actually scientific and that it's repeatable. So yeah, it's important. It's got to be testable, observable, repeatable, and testable.
So what is the philosophy of naturalism and how has it influenced the practice of science?
Yeah, so naturalism came about a couple hundred years ago, roughly. And it's saying that in science, air quote science, everything has to be considered from a naturalistic standpoint, natural causes. You can't invoke a creator or a god to explain anything, even if that's the best explanation for things. That's what we've run into in this day and age, is that there is no natural way to explain living things, even from the complexity of a cell, what DNA is. It's ridiculous to say that you can explain these things in a natural way, and yet that's what the empire forces on us, is that's the only way we can look at these things. So naturalism is basically, it's a new rule. It's part of the hijacking of science. It's a new rule that's been imposed on science, that's taken it away from empirical science and to be more of a kind of a tool of the empire, that everything has to be explained in a natural way. Or guess what? You don't get to explain things. That's kind of a somewhat more recent development, maybe just how cancel culture is really crushing any attempts. When scientists try to explain things and show evidence for a designer, for example, not allowed to, kind of the buzzer goes off and, oh, that's not naturalistic. And so you can't look for that view of things. And actually, just while I was chatting, I was paging back to the, in the front of my book, where I give credit. I say, to all the scientists whose views and work have been hidden, canceled, or crushed by the empire, that's my dedication, the dedication of my book. That's kind of what's been going on. And unfortunately, all of this canceling and crushing and hiding is being done in the name of naturalism.
What is historical science?
Yeah, so it's kind of along the same topic. You can think of sciences like physics and chemistry, you know, the laws of physics, they're very well known. Chemistry and how it works, the chemicals and all, it's very well known. It's highly experimental. For the most part, I get into some of the non-highly, some of the less clear examples later in the book. I have a chapter on kind of more fantasy, science fantasy that's being pushed as science these days. But anyway, so some of the sciences are extremely scientific in terms of what we think of as science. And, you know, what I just talked about is the rules of science and observation and things. But then there's other branches of science where, honestly, as with my background in experimental science and all, when I first really started diving into understanding this, the origins issue, especially, these branches of sciences are not recognizable, or were not recognizable to me as real science. And sometimes they're called historical sciences. In these cases, you know, proof of things is really not possible. And the best you can do is kind of look at a model of things and interpret this way or that. And I'm not just, you know, in case the listener is thinking, yeah, this Jay's just making this up, there's not a real distinction between the good sciences and more of the historical sciences or less real sciences. Way back, almost 200 years ago, there's a guy, William Whewell. He was the master of Trinity College in Cambridge. He wrote two whole volumes on this subject. One was called The History of Inductive Sciences, and the other was called The Philosophy of the Inductive Sciences. And so he puts sciences like physics and chemistry in a totally different category than what he calls the historical sciences or the study of past causes. And so when you get into that category of things, when you're studying past causes, the scientific method is very limited. You know, origins are not observable. Origins are not repeatable. And the hypotheses about these things are rarely testable. So you're kind of operating in a whole nother category that is really distant from kind of the classical sciences.
I'm Todd Wilkin. Your link to Issues Etc. We're discussing the failures of scientism with Jay Sonstrom, author of Loving Science But Not the Empire. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for military chaplains to deliver word and sacrament ministry to Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod military personnel and their families. Learn more at lcms.org/armed forces. Serving those who serve, LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armed forces. On the other side, we will take as an example paleontologist Mary Leakey's attempt to explain human footprints.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Does this sound like your church budget process at the end of the year? You get last year's budget and go through with a committee line by line, maybe what we should spend next year. Maybe you have a prayer. But where's the word of God in this process? When do the people hear what the small catechism says about giving and why we do it? Contact us at LCMS Stewardship so that we can help you fix this process, put the word of God first, and put your congregation on a good footing. LCMS.org/stewardship.
Is your child struggling at school? Are you thinking about homeschooling? Would you like help knowing what to teach and how to teach it? The Simply Classical curriculum from Memoria Press provides an enriching, step-by-step classical Christian education for students who have autism, learning or behavioral difficulties, ADHD, and more. You'll find everything you need, including daily lesson plans to guide your way. Learn more at simplyclassical.com. Use LPR23 to save on your order. Simplyclassical.com.
You and your youth group are invited to the 2023 Higher Things Youth Conference, Beyond Reasonable Doubt, at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, from July 25th through the 28th. Come hear pastors Brian Wolfmuller and Chris Roseborough teach the youth of our church about doubt and apologetics, and give them the assurance that their faith is beyond reasonable doubt. Remaining space is limited. Register now and find more information at higherthings.org.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues Etc. congregational sponsor. Bethlehem Lutheran, Fairborn, Ohio. Faith Lutheran, Dunedin, Florida. Holy Cross Lutheran, Carlisle, Iowa. Emmanuel Lutheran, Pensacola, Florida. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Lititz, Pennsylvania. Peace Lutheran, Sussex, Wisconsin. Risen Savior Lutheran, Basor, Kansas. St. John Lutheran, Waverly, Iowa. St. Peter Lutheran, Arlington, Wisconsin. And Trinity Lutheran, Weatherford, Texas. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support Donate, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the podcast, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Jay Stonstrom is our guest. He spent his career as an experimental scientist for the United States Army's Night Vision Lab. We're talking about the failures of scientism. Jay, you give an example of Mary Leakey's attempt to explain the presence of human footprints in a rock layer that was dated to 3.6 million years ago. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this goes back. This was published in National Geographic in the 1970s. Mary Leakey and the, I don't know if younger people know about the Leakeys. Us older folks were pretty familiar with them because they were always in the news and on National Geographic shows and things. Mary was a very good investigator. They investigated the supposed human ancestry, what they call hominids, which are supposed prehumans. In her investigations out in Africa, they came across these footprints that were kind of set into ash, which had turned into kind of like concrete. In the article is called "The Footprints in the Ashes of Time." So here, Mary and her crew over several years uncovered these footprints. They were kind of covered with tufts of grass and soil and stuff. So they carefully uncover these sets of footprints. They measure the footprints very carefully. They reported them as human-like feet. In fact, a quote from the article says, "The form of the foot was exactly the same as ours." But the problem is they had this layer of rock that the footprints were in. They had it evaluated through radiometric means, which I have a whole chapter on radiometric dating and why I've got issues with that. This is their system. This is the system that she uses. And they came back with a date that these footprints were put there 3.6 million years ago. So the problem with this is that there were not supposed to be anything like, you know, modern humans 3.6 million years ago. There were only prehumans with more ape-like features, more ape-like feet, things like that. So now she's got a dilemma. She's got human footprints set in this ash, but it dates way longer than humans were supposed to be walking the earth. So what to do? Well, the gist of this article is that this is a revolutionary find. And what we now know is that there were prehumans walking the earth at the time, but they had human feet. And so this kind of got integrated into the story of what's called the Australopithecines, which of some listeners may be familiar with Lucy, the story of Lucy. As museums later on started to construct this creature, the museums always made the creature look like kind of an ape-like, half human, half ape, but they always gave it human hands and human feet. And it all goes back to this finding by Mary Leakey of basically human footprints in these ashes. I put this in the book as an example of the historical sciences not being up to par with real sciences, because if you believe in God and you believe in a creator and you believe that people have always been people from the moment they walked the earth, if the only evidence was these footprints, then you go, okay, yes, obviously these were left by human beings. That's my view on it. But Mary Leakey, in order to interpret the same set of footprints, basically creates out of her imagination another type of a prehuman, what they call hominids. Hopefully the listeners kind of getting a flavor for the different historical sciences. In this class, you know, it was definitely anthropology, paleontology. Interpretation is everything. The evidence is often minimal, and the interpretation is everything.
What was the Human Genome Project, and how did it become another example of this methodological naturalism that substitutes for science?
Yeah, so the Human Genome Project was very cool. This was the first time that people came up with the machinery, basically, to map out or figure out what the whole human genome, the genetic code was. Not just genetic code, but DNA. They read nearly the entire strand of DNA for the first time. And that's pretty phenomenal. DNA has about 3 gigabytes of information on it. That's how many little, you know, you think of it, DNA is this double helix, the spiral ladder. So there's over 3 giga steps to this ladder. And this is the first time that they pretty much had read most of it. So getting back to the, I guess, the gist of your question, interestingly, the guy who ran the Human Genome Project was Francis Collins, same Francis Collins who his name has surfaced again repeatedly with COVID and things like that, because he now sits in the hierarchy of our health system. Francis Collins is a Christian, and so he comes out after running the Human Genome Project, he comes out with a book called The Language of God. This was back in 2007. The project finished, I think, in 2003, so this is 20 years ago now. So now they've read almost the whole DNA code, but they only knew about 2% of the code actually did. So they knew what all the, like, think of it as letters, all the DNA letters. They knew what most of the letters were now and what sequence they were in. But they only knew what about 2% of the letters actually did. And that's because the 2% was the letters that do what they call coding for proteins. They have the code that living things use to build protein molecules. And because of the kind of limited understanding of the apparatus and how it worked back then, they could only figure out what 2% of the code was doing. So the people at the time, and Francis Collins, in his book, The Language of God, he basically says, we're getting our first glimpse into our own instruction book, previously known only to God. So here's a scientist who's saying DNA is an instruction book known only to God, but at the same time, not knowing what 98% of the DNA strand did, the geneticists of the time came up with a theory that, which is called junk DNA. They termed it junk DNA at the time. And that is, okay, this 98% of the genome actually isn't doing anything, but what it is, it's a remnant of our evolutionary past. So as evolution developed a human being, for example, which is the code that they'd read in the Human Genome Project, as evolution produced human beings, as it came up with improvements and improvements, it discarded the old DNA that just kind of naturally was left on the DNA strand, but it's just junk now. It doesn't do anything. So Francis Collins actually bought into this idea, and he talks about it in his book, you know, the same book, The Language of God. He also explains why he's an evolutionist. So this to me was kind of mind-boggling. The guy writes, he says he's a Christian. I don't doubt that he is. He writes a book called The Language of God to tell people about that only God can be responsible for DNA. But at the same time, he buys into evolutionism and this concept of junk DNA, that most of what's on the DNA has been discarded as a remnant of our evolutionary past. So what's happened over the last 20 years is that scientists have figured out how to read the rest of it, how to tell what it's doing. And it may be never that scientists actually figure out what all the DNA is doing. But what they now know is that all this junk DNA, it's actually active. It's being read by things in the cells. And so it's not junk at all. And as they come to better understand how it's functioning, what it turns out is, in this chapter in my book, I call it DNA Part One. I call it the revelation. What the revelation is that all this DNA is actually the operating system of the cell. Just like your computer has an operating system and your phone has an operating system, every cell has an operating system. And it's all that part of that 98% of the DNA that they call junk DNA. It's actually the operating system. It's complex beyond belief. Like I said, we may never figure it all out, what it's doing and how it works. The code is so complex that much of the code is being used for multiple purposes. It can be read one way or another way, depending on what the researcher is investigating. It overlaps in such a way that it's just ridiculous. The genius, that's what was behind making these sections of DNA code that can actually overlap and still make sense when they need to be used and read. So, I mean, in the book, I put in analogies to computer systems and like 3D printers and things like that, to try to help the reader understand what's going on with the DNA code. But bottom line is, there is no junk DNA. That's been like one of the worst black eyes on science in the last two decades. And we now know better, but guess what? Unless you get books like mine and read them, you'll probably never hear about this because the Empire does not want you to know.
Jay Sonstrom is our guest. He spent his career as an experimental scientist for the United States Army's Night Vision Lab. We'll talk about the complexity of the cell right after this.
Beloved in the Lord, let us draw near with a true heart and confess our sins unto God our Father.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, 7:30 Mountain, and 6:30 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
When you hear the word heresy, what do you think of? Do you think of some ancient debate the church has gotten over and forgotten? Do you think of some stubby old theologians just arguing over things that don't matter? There's a lot more to heresies than you might think. And that's what the August issue of the Lutheran Witness is all about. Heresies, ancient and modern. To pick up your copy, visit cph.org/witness or visit our website, witness.lcms.org, to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Our Christian faith is under constant attack, and we must be proactive in keeping our children in the church. At Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, we believe that an education rooted in God's Word is one that stands against the very gates of hell. Nothing in this world is more important. Offering a rigorous classical Lutheran education, we provide in-person and live online remote learning opportunities for preschool through grade 12. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
Are you attending the LCMS National Convention? Ad Crucem is partnering with Confessional Lutheran Fellowship of Facebook to help members of CLF identify each other at the convention. If you're a member of CLF, pop on over to our booth to get your free CLF sticker and to see all our wonderful Christ-focused products. Visit adcrucem.com or booth 222 at the LCMS convention.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the failures of scientism with Jay Sonstrom. Dr. Donna Harrison writes in the latest Issues, Etc. journal about her life as a young researcher, her disillusionment with science in many ways. When, as a young researcher, she informed her professor that a piece of equipment that was being used in the research was faulty and that would invalidate all their previous research, she was told that they didn't want to lose their grant. She writes, "That was a cataclysmic moment for me. The concrete foundations on which my idol rested were collapsing under the earthquake. I left the project realizing that some, maybe even a lot of what is published in scientific literature was published for the sake of obtaining grant money so researchers could survive. This, of course, is the opposite of truth-seeking." You can read the entire Wittenberg Trail feature by Dr. Donna Harrison in the online Issues, Etc. journal. It's absolutely free. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the red subscription button, enter your email address, and we will send you the online Issues, Etc. journal. So, can the evolutionary model explain the complexity of the cell, Jay?
Oh, man, yeah. The short answer, it's impossible. People, I think, again, people tend to have no concept of how complex a cell is. I have a little bullet list. So chapter 4 of my book is titled The Cell, Mind-Boggling Complexity. I start the second page of the chapter with a bullet list of things that are in a cell, which probably most people just don't really understand that how complex it is. Cells have power plants with almost 100% efficient generators in them. Cells have a transportation system, maintenance system, doors and windows. They have gates, a security system, mail delivery system, loading docks, rooms, hallways, elevators, railroads, with engines and tracks, scaffolding, self-sealing walls, control systems. We talked about the operating system, artificial languages. Cells are full of molecular machines. Some of the molecular machines build others of the molecular machines. And then they have these communication systems. Mail delivery? Are you kidding me? In the book, I make an analogy to, well, it used to be a few decades ago, people would talk about a cell being kind of as complex as a factory, maybe. But we're way beyond that now. You think of anything in a major metropolitan city goes on to make the city run and function, and cells have all of these things. And to propose, as as the evolutionists do, that this could have come about by natural processes is just a pipe dream. There's a lot of imagination involved in thinking that could be, and of course, it also completely defies the second law of thermodynamics.
What are the various chicken or egg problems in the cell that naturalistic science simply can't explain?
That's kind of a fun thing to think about. One of my favorites, but maybe the strongest one that I think of, is the ribosome. A ribosome is, some of the scientists have described it as the most complex machine on Earth. Basically, everything in the ribosome is a mechanical moving part. And the ribosome is actually used as part of reading DNA and then building proteins out of it. And going back to your biology class for listeners, maybe remember, and if you had bio in high school, you learned about transcription and translation of DNA. Well, the ribosome is involved in the translation of DNA. And as far as the chicken and egg problem, well, here's the thing. So the ribosome, this extremely complex machine, takes the messenger RNA after it's been transcribed. It uses it to build proteins. Everything in your body pretty much is built out of proteins. And they're built together in different ways to make different cells and different components of cells and so on. But the ribosome itself is made up of all these proteins. It's made of, I think 70 some different types of proteins. And each protein has to be first built, and then they all have to be assembled together to make a ribosome. But the ribosome itself is needed to build the proteins. So it's just, it's ludicrous to think that you could have had a ribosome somehow get built just out of random events when the ribosome is needed actually to build itself. That's one example. Hopefully I didn't get too complex for the listening audience. Another one, ATP. I call it this is a whopper of an example. ATP is kind of the little power charge that at the microscopic level of microbiology, it powers every cell, it powers every living thing, and without it, the cell is dead. But the ATP also requires these micro machines called ATP synthase. So this is another microscopic machine that builds the ATP, but for the machine to get built itself, it needs ATP. So to build ATP synthase, you need a scat of ATP that's operating in the cell, but you can't have ATP until the ATP synthase is built. So it's absurd to imagine that all of the needed parts and processes just somehow arrived at the same time on their own, and that this micro-metropolis that is the cell just suddenly sprang to life with all of these things working. Somewhere else in the book, I use the expression, piecemeal makes no sense. To have a functioning cell, you need a functioning cell to build a functioning cell. There's just no explanation for them outside of that.
What is epigenetic information?
Yeah, so I spent a while talking about DNA, and generally we think that everything needed to build an organism is in the DNA, and actually it's not too long ago that was the generally accepted view of things. But it turns out that every cell is full of other forms of information that are not in the DNA. They appear in different forms. Some of them are like imprints on the skin of a cell. Some of them are extremely complex. It's like one of the things is there's imprints on the outside of a cell that give it electromagnetic features that are used to do different things. There's something now called the sugar code, where sugars in the cell are formed in such a way that they contain information. And it turns out that especially in building a body, whether the body's a human being or, you know, the various different types of tissues or bones and things like that in a human being, that some of that information is in the DNA that goes into building the things, especially, of course, building all the proteins. That's in the DNA. But there's this epigenetic information that also sits elsewhere in cells. And again, it's all kinds of ways, means of that this information resides, but it's epigenetic. It's outside of the gene. And so that's kind of been a revelation of really last couple decades as people have been figuring out that there is epigenetic information and that it really is a whole nother level of complexity that people didn't even realize. And I think the only explanation is, you know, just this ingenious creator God who came up with all these ideas and put them into place. And like I said, I mean, piecemeal makes no sense. This whole system has to be just like set in place and like zapped into being. And it all starts up at once and it all functions at once, or it doesn't function at all.
You say that Charles Darwin can be excused for promoting evolutionary theory. Why is that?
Because back in his time, he and everybody else were ignorant about all these complexities that I've been talking about. The complexity of a cell, to them, the cell was, I have a quote in the book, this is also in the chapter on the cell, and it's mind-boggling complexity. There was a guy from Darwin's time called Ernest Haeckel. A quote I have from him, he says, the cell was a simple little lump of albuminous combination of carbon. I put this as ignorance was bliss back then, since the cell was just a simple blob. Any amount of storytelling was allowed to advance the Darwinian theory. So he didn't have to explain all these complexities that I'm talking about. There was a lot of hand-waving involved. And as I've studied this issue of our origins, and especially evolutionism versus creationism, I read the opposition literature, I read the creationist literature, I read the literature of the empire. Of course, I read The Origin of Species, which is Darwin's main and highly revered book. In his book, I have it in PDF version, so one day I did a search for the terms suppose or supposed, and Darwin used that term in his book about 150 times. So it was easy for him to just keep saying, well, suppose this is like this, then this could have happened that way. Or suppose that is like that, then this could have come about that way. And then also I searched for the term assumed. He used the term assumed over 40 times. So, you know, if you assume that the cell works like this, then you can imagine that such and such can happen. And so given all that and not knowing actually what's in the cell and just hand-waving and assuming and supposing, you can come up with great stories. And that's what he did in The Origin of Species. Now, with what we know, there's no excuse anymore. In fact, in his own book, The Origin of Species, he knew that someday real science could maybe test his theory. And this is what he wrote in his book. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. So I say today we are there in spades. Today we have no excuse.
Give us some examples of how naturalism and materialism dominate the scientific discipline of biology.
Well, it's the only way you're allowed to explain things. You know, knowing now, I think, how complex biological things are, more and more biologists are coming to understand that Darwinism is dead. It can't explain these things. And yet in their literature, what they write and say, they still have to say that it explains these things. In my chapter that I call What is the Empire, actually, I give an example of this, of a reporter who's interviewing a molecular biologist, and the reporter says to him, "Do you believe that the information evolved?" And the biologist says, "George, nobody I know in my profession believes it evolved. It was engineered by genius beyond genius, and such information could not have been written in any other way. The paper and the ink did not write the book. Knowing what we know, it's ridiculous to think otherwise." Then the guy doing the interview says, "Have you ever stated that in a public lecture or in any public writings?" And he says, "No, I just say it evolved. To be a molecular biologist requires one to hold on to two insanities at all times. One, it would be insane to believe in evolution when you can see the truth for yourself. Two, it would be insane to say you don't believe in evolution. All government work, research grants, papers, big college lectures, everything would stop. I'd be out of a job or relegated to the outer fringes where I couldn't earn a decent living." So this is a quote by a guy who's done a career in molecular biology. And the problem is it's like that all through. The empire rules everything this way. Even, you know, as people come to realize that things can't be explained by evolutionary means anymore, they still have to claim that they can be explained that way or say that they're explained that way. And then they have to portray that to the public, and they have to teach it that way in our school systems. So, yeah, it's a sad commentary on things, what's supposed to be the discipline of biology. When it comes to the facts of biology, just what things are, how they work, things like that, I mean, that's fine. All of that, the factual things, I'm sure, are fine. But when they go to explain how they came to be, that's when you run into this, the topic of materialism, you know, and only materialistic explanations are allowed. And I talk in the book, too, about there was a movie called Expelled, subtitle, No Intelligence Allowed. I don't know if you guys had seen this movie. It came out about 20 years ago. It's a great film, and if the listeners haven't seen that, you can go and look it up on YouTube. Just look up Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, and you can run the movie at home and watch it. But the whole topic of the movie Expelled is that, you know, people are being silenced. 20 years ago, people were being expelled from jobs, you know, in molecular biology or as professors, if they just brought up the topic of intelligent design. I don't think I mentioned that term yet in this interview, so listeners should be aware that, you know, starting about 30 years ago, a movement in science began that's called the intelligent design movement. And that was biologists, chemists, molecular biologists started to realize that Darwinism was insufficient to explain things. And they started to write books on these things. And they started to get banned and blacklisted. And, you know, we talk about cancel culture these days. It just really, while I was writing my own book here, it really set into me that cancel culture has been going against scientists who promote the intelligent design movement or creationists in general. Canceled culture has been canceling them for decades now because the empire does not allow you to talk about these things.
Jay Sonstrom is a member of Our Savior's Way Lutheran Church in Ashburn, Virginia. He's a physicist and optical engineer. He spent his career as an experimental scientist for the United States Army's Night Vision Lab. He's author of the book Loving Science, But Not the Empire. He'll be back tomorrow for part two of The Failures of Scientism. Also tomorrow, we'll continue our series responding to Roman Catholic proof texts with Dr. Stephen Parks, and we'll respond to your email, talkback@issuesetc.org, and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.